Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet. I'm Irene Quayle.
One by one, Koch takes the fluffy little creatures out and holds them in his hand. You can see their tiny teeth as they screech.
Around this time of year, we have Bat Appreciation Day, the Day of Endangered Species, the International Day for Biodiversity. We're great at naming days after our animals and plants. But are we treating them wisely or failing them badly?
I don't see why farmers should protect the forest just because they are talking that the climate change is coming, there is a problem with the flooding and so on. So what? The farmer will ask you. But if you tell him, by planting the improved material, you harvest it in 3 years' time, you diversify the source of your income, he will start listening to why this ecosystem should be protected.
From the banks of Germany's River Sieg to the magnificent forests of Cameroon. Stories as diverse as our living planet. What comes to your mind when you hear the word wilderness? The Great Plains of Africa, the American Wild West, or the Australian Outback? The chances are you won't think of the Netherlands, with an area of just 41,000 square kilometres and around 17 million inhabitants. It's one of the 30 most densely populated countries in the world. But there, of all places, a nature reserve was set up a few decades ago, named the New Wilderness, the Oostvaardersplassen. Now the Dutch have become fiercely divided over this nature reserve and the way it's managed. Brigitte Oosterhout filed this story from the Netherlands. It's presented by Ineke Moos.
In Abe and Angelica's garden, 35 kilometres east of Amsterdam, dozens of plastic bags are piled up.
These bags are full of hay. It's already loose, so we can easily throw it over the fence. That saves time and reduces the risk of being caught.
Kans opgepakt worden.
The elderly couple lives close to the Dutch nature reserve, Oostvaardersplassen. Twice a day, Abe and Angelica take several bags of hay to the reserve to feed the animals that live there, wild horses, hek cattle and red deer.
In the evenings, we drive from one place to the next to find out where we can feed them. We have to keep away from the park rangers and the police because feeding is illegal.
As they are considered wild, the animals in the Oostvaardersplassen aren't supposed to get fed. Since the end of February, everyone who does so risks a fine. The nature reserve covers 56 square kilometres, or 22 square miles. A fence around it keeps the big grazers like horses, cattle and deer inside this area. Each winter, about one-third of the animals die due to food scarcity. But many are killed by the park rangers because they are too weak to survive the winter. Like many others, Abe and Angelica feel they have to help the animals.
At some point, you see those videos about suffering animals on social media. You want to know what's going on there. Then you can't turn a blind eye to it any longer. And suddenly, you're called an animal rights activist. Well, so be it.
Let it be.
Absoluut belachelijk is, eigenlijk strafbaar zou moeten zijn.
Daar is Hans.
Abe and Angelica are not the only ones who object to the way the nature reserve is managed. It has sparked off a national protest movement. Animal lovers regularly demonstrate at the fence of the nature reserve. Sometimes those demonstrations escalate and people get arrested. This winter, more horses, deer and cattle died than ever before. In total, almost 3,000 animals. That's 57% of all the grazers that were living on the reserve back in October. The protesters are outraged. They call the Oostvaardersplassen the killing fields. 50 years ago, the Oostvaardersplassen developed in a polder, an artificial piece of land created by the Dutch. it became a wetland, where many endangered birds chose to rest over winter or settle permanently. But researchers feared that trees and shrubs would soon overgrow on this very special landscape. In the 1980s and 90s, they introduced hardy hek cattle, Cornish ponies and red deer to keep the grassland around the wetlands open. There is no hunting to control the number of grazers, as is the case in many other nature reserves in Europe. As a consequence, animals reproduce exponentially in good times and die off in bad times, just as they do in the wild. Hans-Erik Kuipers is a park ranger in the Oostvaardersplassen.
In summer, when there is enough to feed on, the animals build up their fat reserves. Those who aren't able to do that properly, because they are old, sick, or have poor teeth, those animals are the weakest, and they will die in winter. That's how it works in nature, and here in the Oostvaardersplassen too. We try to stick to natural processes as much as possible.
Han Olf, a biologist at the University of Groningen, supports this approach. Those animals live a happy life, he explains.
It's crazy that people care so much about how an animal dies, but not about other aspects of its well-being, such as, can a young animal grow up with its parents? Is an animal free to choose its herd and its partner? This welfare discussion centers around the assumption that animals need abundant food 12 months a year. In my view, that's quite a limited definition of welfare.
There are other scientists who call for the so-called rewilding experiment to stop. Amongst them is Frank Behrenzer, an emeritus professor of ecology and conservation at the University of Wageningen. He used to be in favour of the project, but changed his mind last year after a PhD student of his took a closer look at the biodiversity in the area. The study showed that in the grassland where cattle, horses and deer live, species such as endangered birds are disappearing. Behrenzer calls for restrictions on the number of grazers, be it by hunting, castration or some other measure.
We zien ook geen andere plekken in Europa.
There is no other place in Europe where cattle and horses can reproduce without limitation like this. Why should we in the Netherlands, in this small, densely populated country, try to copy a situation like they have in Africa or other places, where there is room for herds of wild beasts and zebras to migrate over thousands of kilometers, moving with the rain? That's simply impossible here.
Ja, dat is natuurlijk in Nederland volstrekt onmogelijk.
There is one thing, though, which all scientists agree on. Feeding the animals with hay will only make matters worse in the long term. As a consequence, they will reproduce even faster, so that next winter, food will be even scarcer and even more animals will have to die. But Abe and Angelica won't listen to this kind of argument. They want to help those animals now. Some cattle are already waiting at the fence.
Come on.
Come here, sweetie. Look, here's something to eat.
Oh, kom maar groter. Kom maar. Ga maar eten. Oh.
The cattle come closer and start to chew on the hay.
Volgens mij een jaarling.
This cow is about a year old. And look how skinny it is. You can see its ribs.
Hij is wat aan de magere kant. De ribbetjes zie je.
At the end of February, regional authorities actually ordered the park rangers to feed the animals with hay themselves, just to calm down the public. But it didn't stop the protests, and it didn't stop animal rights activists like Ib and Angelica bringing additional tons of hay to the nature reserve, donated by farmers from all over the country.
Dag koetjes.
Bye-bye, cows. See you later. Eat well.
Lekker eten nu.
The Oostvaardersplassen was planned to be the ideal nature reserve. But this new wilderness is starting to tear Dutch society apart. Park rangers have even received death threats. Even people who don't care much about animals say that something has to change. It simply can't go on like this for much longer.
Ineke Moos presented that report, filed by Brigitte Osterat. Some bat species migrate over long distances here in Europe, and they're increasingly threatened by human pressure on their habitats. Building projects and an increasing number of wind turbines take a heavy toll, but so far we don't know enough about them to document the real extent of the losses. Scientists say we need to find out more about bats' seasonal migration patterns to give them enough space to survive. Melina Grundmann went out with a team of bat experts to catch, count and band some of these elusive creatures of the night.
Here we are at the estuary of the River Sieg. And in this area, two things come together which are vital for bat populations. This is food. There's insects the bats can hunt on. And there are roosting opportunities with all the woodpecker cavities in the trees.
The mouth of the Sieg River in Germany is a traditional stopover for migratory bats. Every spring and autumn, they stay here for nearly a month before they continue on their way in search of more abundant food sources in warmer locations. A warning sign appears on the way into the forest. Caution, beware of breaking branches. Bats in residence. Martin Koch is a researcher at the University of Trier. At the moment, he comes here almost twice a week to count migratory bats and to put a ring on them if they don't already have one.
They have very long migration distances, like 1,500 kilometers. They can't migrate the whole distance in one night, so they need stopover sites. And usually these stopover sites are very traditional, so it's important to identify this key habitats for migrating bats to keep a network of suitable habitats in Europe so the bats can actually really pass through all the countries in Europe.
Migratory bats in this part of the world fly north in spring. Some only fly to the northern parts of Germany, others make their way to Estonia and other Baltic countries. In autumn they move south, as far as southern France.
They are true European animals.
When it comes to the bat population in Germany, there is far too little data. It's impossible to say whether the population is remaining stable, decreasing or even increasing. One method of monitoring is to look into bat boxes. These are small, dark, wooden boxes with little chinks attached to the top of a tree trunk. In the Sieg estuary, about 200 of them have already been installed. The aim is to make up for the lack of dead wood and give the bats the opportunity to roost. Koch climbs up a ladder to look into one of the boxes. And yes, there are indeed bats inside. He comes down with 6 little bats safely stored in a can. Most of them are hiding under the lid. Their day hasn't started yet. One by one, Koch takes the fluffy little creatures out and holds them in his hand. You can see their tiny teeth as they screech.
So now we have a protocol we follow to take several measurements of the bat. So we take the weight, we take the forearm length, and see if it's a juvenile or an adult bat.
Another method is setting up nets. It's now dark and we're standing on a small wooden bridge within the forest. Martin Koch and Talia Jenke, who is a research assistant at the Bat Banding Center in Bonn, now stretch out a net above the bridge together.
This is actually a good place to catch bats here. It's a narrow path through where the bats have to fly by, and we can cover the complete gap here between the trees with one net. So this is our opportunity to catch the bats.
If a bat flies into the net, they carefully grab it and put it into a box to measure it later on, one by one. Counting bats is a laborious task. Researchers get the bats from bat banding centers. There are only 2 places in Germany where you can get those bats, one in Bonn and another one in Dresden.
Banding is a very good and easy way to collect data over several years. So we have often recoveries from maybe 20, 12 years before.
In Germany, bat banding has a long history. The sociologist Martin Eisentraut started banding bats in Berlin in 1932. Later, he became the director of the famous Natural History Museum König in Bonn. So he brought bat banding with him to Bonn in the 1960s. Although the method has been around for a long time, there's still far too little data on bats.
We have regions in Germany where a lot of people go out and band bats and do research on bats. And on the other hand, there are regions where no research on bats is done and where no data are collected. Yeah, and this is sometimes a bit problematic because we don't know if there are no bats or if there are no data about bats in those regions.
But collecting data on bats is getting more and more important. Koch explains why.
Bats might be affected by so many political decision-making in terms of wind energy development, in terms of forestry, in terms of agriculture and the use of pesticides and the reduction of available food insects for the bats. So it is actually important to measure what is going on in the environment, and bats are actually a very good indicator for habitat health.
One of the biggest problems for bats in flight is colliding with wind turbines. Koch proposes adjusting the operating patterns of the turbines to match the bats' migration routine.
When you actually stop the windmills, when the migrating bats come passing by, then you lose about maximum 5% of economic income. But you save a lot of bats because there are up to 10 bats per year per windmill which are dying in Germany, and there are almost 30,000 windmills. So it's a huge number of bats.
Another key issue to be tackled at the political level is the controversial use of pesticides, which play a major role in the decline of insects, the main source of food for bats. More data is needed to provide scientific evidence that will convince politicians that action is needed to protect the threatened species. After all, they have a lot of benefits to the ecosystem. They eat insects which would otherwise destroy crops. Protecting the bats would provide a natural form of pest control. Then farmers would need less pesticide, which would be good news for bats and humans alike. So for Koch and Jenke, that means keep on catching, banding and counting bats to gather evidence. Tonight, we collected about 30 bats. More to come in the next few days. For DW, I'm Elina Grundmann in Bonn.
It's now 32 years since reactor 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power station exploded, resulting in catastrophic radioactive contamination. A 30-kilometer exclusion zone around the power plant became known as a dead zone. But now that the area has been left to its own devices, new life is evolving in the radioactive wasteland. Equipped with a Geiger counter, DW's Nicholas Connolly went to see how nature is adapting.
The skylarks are singing their hearts out as we cross a meadow surrounded on all sides by dense forest. Every now and then, we come across ruined farm buildings. We're looking out for one of Chernobyl's most charismatic inhabitants, the wild Przewalski's horse. A heavy-built species that lives in big family groups. In theory, they should be easy to spot, but not today. Our guide, biologist Serhii Paskevich, gets out his phone, hoping for some reception. Motion-triggered photo traps dotted around the exclusion zone help to keep track of wildlife movements. Just a few kilometres from where we're standing, his cameras pick up a wolf ambling past, apparently in no hurry. Outside the reserve, wolves spend most of the day in hiding. Here in Chernobyl, there are now very few humans to avoid. The wolf population here is now thought to be 7 times higher than before the catastrophe, but still, no sign of the horses. Serhii takes us to an abandoned barn. The ground has been dug up and the floor is littered with what looks like blonde hair.
That's from the horses' manes. They come in here to scratch themselves. They love to get a rub along the walls.
But that's not all they're looking for in here.
They smashed the wood barrels that were here and ate what was inside, as well as the earth floor underneath. That's how badly they needed the salt they could find here.
No one showed these horses how to do this. In the space of just a few decades, they've learned to make the most of the human-made landscape of abandoned villages, just as they've adapted to Chernobyl's forests, which are also nothing like their original habitat, the steppes of Central Asia. Worldwide, fewer than 2,000 Przewalski's horses remain. All belong to populations that have been semi-captive at some point. The Chernobyl herd now numbers over 100. Scientists brought them here in the 1990s, in the hope that they would keep the grass down and prevent wildfires from threatening what remains of the reactor. And while they've singularly failed with that task, their adaptation to Chernobyl offers biologists a rare opportunity to study behavioural evolution in action. It's time to check the radiation levels. After all, we're only 20 kilometres from the reactor.
The background radiation here is the same as in Kiev, where we are now. The radiation has migrated into deeper levels of the soil, but that reading doesn't mean it's safe here.
It's one thing visiting for a few hours, but how has the radiation affected the horses? Their diet consists of vegetation that grows on contaminated soils. Serhii has spent the past 20 years studying the effect of radiation as it passes through the ecosystem.
Of course, radiation builds up in the horses, but it's not fatal. Their internal cell processes are very strong. The amount of radiation these horses are exposed to isn't enough to affect their health or reproduction. At least I haven't seen any anomalies, any two-headed horses.
It's a conclusion shared by most international scientists. But what about his own health?
So far, everything's been fine.
We get a call from one of Seri's colleagues. A family group has just been spotted grazing next to the main road leading to the power station. We jump into the car. And sure enough, there they are, no more than 100 metres from the road, under the gaze of an enthusiastic group of tourists, some of the approximately 1,000 visitors who come to the Chernobyl zone every day. It seems they were hiding in plain sight all along. The male stands aside, watching us closely, while the females and last year's foals graze seemingly oblivious, their blonde manes flapping in the wind. They look very well fed. Serhii tells us that this year's foals have just been born in recent weeks, but for now, their mothers will be keeping a low profile in the forest. Since they were first introduced, the Chernobyl population of Przewalski's horses has already tripled in size. A group has even found its way across the border into the Belarusian part of the exclusion zone.
This is a very aggressive species. They can stand up for themselves. Wolves won't be able to catch a healthy horse. They're fast and they can defend themselves.
But what exactly will limit their further expansion? Will it be a lack of suitable habitat or competition between family groups? That's the subject of Serhii's next study. For now, faintly exasperated by our camera team, the herd trots off towards the forest. The forest that keeps on growing and in just a few years will surely swallow up this meadow. Nick Connolly, DW Kiev.
The Congo Basin rainforest is spread across six countries in Central Africa. It's a biodiversity hotspot, home to hundreds of tree species, some 10,000 plant species and endangered wildlife, including forest elephants, gorillas and chimpanzees. But the forest is disappearing at an alarming rate. It's often being cleared for agriculture. Now environmentalists are trying to get farmers to adopt more sustainable methods to make growing crops compatible with forest protection. DW's Ngala Kilian Chimtom sent us this report from Cameroon. It's presented by Crispin Mwakideu.
In the searing equatorial heat, Emmanuel Koo and his family are busy planting fruit-bearing tree plants on their two-acre maize and cassava farm. They are practicing a farming technique introduced by the Wild Agroforestry Centre, or ICRAF. It's designed to improve farmers' yields and to keep the Congo River Basin forest alive. The Congo River Basin rainforest spans some 500 million acres and is rich in biodiversity. With over 600 tree species and 1,000 animal species, including elephants, gorillas and chimpanzees. The forests are being cleared to make way for economic interests such as agriculture, mining and industry, putting biodiversity on the line. The Worldwide Fund for Nature, also known as WWF, estimates that the forest could lose two-thirds of its size if current trends continue. Hanson Njerforti, country director for WWF, says the environmental impact could be devastating.
The Amazon and the Congo Basin forests are really the lungs of the earth.
And it is the responsibility not only of Cameroon, not only of the countries of the Congo Basin, it's the responsibility of the whole world to protect this forest.
Farming is one of the major causes of deforestation in the Congo River Basin, which is why the Wild Agroforestry Center introduced agroforestry to the region. It allows farmers to earn money while using less farmland, and that reduces the need for deforestation. It is this system that Emmanuel Koo from Anyajua in Cameroon's northwest region is now using. He began farming when he couldn't get a white-collar job, but he didn't find it easy. The soil was failing and the yield was poor. Now, thanks to agroforestry practices introduced by ICRAF, farmers like Koo have escaped a life of poverty. He used to farm cocoa and coffee for export, as well as vegetables. But now he has found a way to make greater returns from his farm. Koo has stabilized his income, becoming less dependent on cash crops.
Farmers in the domain of agroforestry have a stable lifestyle because the fruit trees integrated and medicinal plants cause them to harvest throughout the whole year rather than waiting for coffee that comes on only at the end of the year.
Most of the trees planted here are non-timber fruit-bearing varieties. Zach Chonjeo, regional coordinator at the Wild Agroforestry Center for West and Central Africa, explains how the program began.
We started from the scratch. The thing we did was to see that, okay, this farmer has land, he's based in the rural area, and then he's keen to accept new technology. But we never do all the work for the farmer. We empower him with the techniques, and we accompany him. Because if you come and build everything, the day your project will stop, everything will fall apart. And this is what we are avoiding.
The Wild Agroforestry Center estimates that more than 100,000 farmers across Cameroon are already benefiting from this new way of farming. Chunjeo says it is part of a larger scheme to conserve the Congo River Basin rainforest.
I don't see why farmers should protect the forest just because they are talking that the climate change is coming, there is a problem with the flooding and so on. So what? The farmer will ask you. But if you tell him by planting the improved material, you harvest it in 3 years' time, you diversify the source of your income, it will start listening to why this ecosystem should be protected.
Hanson Girfoti from the Worldwide Fund for Nature agrees that local populations can be weaned off destructive farming practices through agroforestry techniques. But he also says big polluters should pay for damage they have caused. Countries that emit the least emissions suffer the most from climate change. Richard Munang, the Regional Climate Change Coordinator for the UN Environment Programme, says that's where the Green Climate Fund comes in.
If you look at the African continent today, take into consideration the reality of the African continent that needs $50 billion to fund climate change adaptation, what has been coming to the continent today is just up to about $2 billion to fund climate change adaptation. The capitalization of the Green Climate Fund is currently at $10.3 billion to be shared across all the 197 countries that are actually a party to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change across the globe. This amount is a far cry from the $100 billion annually by 2020 that was pledged.
Africa stands to suffer tremendously as global temperatures rise. But environmentalists hope the widespread adoption of agroforestry will safeguard the forests of the Congo River Basin and help mitigate the effects of climate change.
That report was filed by Ngala Kilian Chimtom and presented by Crispin Mwakideo. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Our program was produced with the help of Celestina Wazike and Michael Springer. You can listen to Living Planet anytime, online as a podcast, or on iTunes or SoundCloud. You'll also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Irene Quayle. Until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now. Na, 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 na.